Radio Prague News.
Former Prime Minister and ex-chairman of the Social Democrats, Jiří Paroubek, has announced that he's stepping down as chairman of his party, Left 21. The ANO party, along with the Social Democrats and the three-way coalition of the Greens, the Christian Democrats and Mayors and Independents, have agreed on a division of responsibilities at Prague City Hall. And Prague is hosting an international conference on home births, a highly controversial topic in the Czech Republic. Former Prime Minister and ex-chairman of the Social Democrats, Jiří Paroubek, announced on Friday that he's stepping down as chairman of his party Left 21. Mr. Paroubek told the website vaševiec.cz that he wanted to devote more time to his family and focus on business and publishing activities, adding that his return to politics was unlikely. Jiří Paroubek, who is now 62, headed the Social Democratic Party from 2006 to 2010 and served as Prime Minister between 2005 and 2006. After leaving the Social Democrats in 2011, he established his own left-oriented party, Left 21, which failed to win seats in the lower house in the past general election. Mr. Paroubek currently works as economic advisor. The ANO party, along with the Social Democrats and the three-way coalition of the Greens, the Christian Democrats and Mayors and Independents, have agreed on a division of responsibilities at Prague City Hall and on the members of the 11-member City Council. Adriana Krnáčová of the ruling ANO party will run for the post of mayor. The winning party will also take four seats on the council and hold the city's finances, security, health and housing. The Social Democrats will be responsible for transport, social policy, European funds and education, while the three-way coalition will get the departments of environment, culture and infrastructure. Vojtěch Filip, deputy chair of the lower house and head of the Communist Party, on Friday defended his recent trip to Moscow, which was condemned by the majority of Czech MPs. Mr. Filip insisted it was an official trip of the lower chamber, approved by its head Jan Hamáček of the Social Democrats. He also said the main topic on his agenda was the impact of the EU sanctions against Russia on Czech companies. Mr. Filip visited the Russian parliament last Wednesday at the invitation of its vice chairman Sergei Zhelezniak, who is one of the Russian officials targeted by the EU and US sanctions. Minister Svatopluk Němeček of the Social Democrats has accused media controlled by the Agrofert company, which is owned by ANO party leader Andrej Babiš, of publishing lies and trying to damage his reputation. Mr. Němeček denied information published by the Mladá fronta Dnes Daily and iDnes.cz website on Friday, claiming that the health ministry had advocated stem cell treatment for patients suffering from diabetes. Finance Minister Babiš reacted on Twitter by saying that the health minister should undergo alcohol addiction and psychiatric treatment. Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka told the Czech news agency that the dispute will be discussed at a special coalition meeting. Prague is hosting an international conference on home births, a highly controversial topic in the Czech Republic. Although births at home are officially not allowed for safety reasons, hundreds of women are opting for home deliveries and increasing pressure on lawmakers to make this an option. In response to the pressure, an amendment to the law now allows women to give birth only with the help of a midwife, although the birth must still take place in a medical institution where doctors could take over in the event of an emergency. Advocates of home birth are pushing for a complete liberalization of the law, which would allow women to deliver in the comfort of their own home. My name is Ruth Franíková, and that's the end of the news.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, preparations are in full swing for a carnival to mark the 25th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution. We'll tell you more. Also bring you the week's business news, and later on in the arts, Jan Wellinger talks to Stephen Morris, author of the Prague-based urban fantasy Come Hell or High Water. All that coming up, so do please stay with us. They call themselves a carnival, hundreds of performer activists seeking to mark the anniversary of the Velvet Revolution with a twist. Less wreath-laying and somber recollections, and more masks, costumes, parades, workshops, and countless other events highlighting pressing issues, whether environmental or social. This is the organization's third year, operating out of a provisional headquarters in the heart of Prague's Old Town. Dominik Yoon spoke to Maria Knapp, Public Relations Director for the Velvet Carnival, and began by asking her to describe the event.
The Velvet Carnival is an association of, let's say, 15 social initiatives. We would like to present the problems that we have in our society at the moment this year by a funny and satiric way. We create a big, huge paper mask that we carry on the 17th of November. And by this way, we want to first honor the way that we have our democracy for 25 years now. And we want to show that the public and the democracy is still living, but in a funny way, not pathetic way.
And you are based, I understand, in Cihelna, in a large building there in Prague's Old Town, in Malá Strana. So you've occupied this space for like a period of time, and all these different initiatives are preparing there for this march. How exactly does that work? What's the atmosphere like there?
I would say that the atmosphere is rather a punk atmosphere, because the building that we are, the Velvet Center in Cihelna number 4, it's really old building. It haven't been reconstructed since then, since 70s. But we have a great option to use it for our art workshops, create masks there. And also we almost every other night, we open there at the culture event. We have culture events like documentary screenings, like a reading from some new books, discussions, and so on. So we've created this Velvet Center into I would say punk place, mm-hmm. full of culture, with a free entry and open for everyone who is interested to come in.
So tell me about some of these initiatives. What specific groups or charities or initiatives or whatever, what specific groups are partaking this year?
At the moment, I think that we will have around 50 initiatives taking part in the Velvet Centrum. We will have topics like Tosara, taking care of a Roma minority and Roma issues, Člověk Tísně, people in need, Greenpeace, Nadeje, who take care of people without home, homeless people, and so on. All of the information can be found on our webpage. And I'd like to invite anyone who would like to come to see the last art workshop that will take place this coming weekend. This will be the last weekend when we will create our masks.
Maria Knapp, Public Relations Director for the Velvet Carnival, speaking there to Radio Prague's Dominik Yoon. And now, this being Friday, it's time to bring you the week's business news, for which I'm joined by Ruth Frankova.
The European Commission this week released its economic growth forecast for the Czech Republic, which predicts a growth of 2.5% for 2014 and 2.7% for the next 2 years. In recent days, Czech institutions, which previously issued more optimistic growth forecasts, have revised them down sharply. On Thursday, the Czech Central Bank revised its economic growth forecast for 2014 down to 2.5% from its previous July estimate of 2.9%. Next year's growth, which it previously estimated at 3%, was also revised down to 2.5%. The finance ministry issued an even more sober estimate, bringing its economic growth forecast for this year down from 2.7% to 2.4%. The Czech government wants to push through a long-term energy plan based on nuclear and coal power, Industry and Trade Minister Jan Mládek told Czech television this week. Mr. Mládek said the cabinet did not want to go down the route of gas-fueled power stations or large-scale support for renewable resources, which would be expensive and a burden on taxpayers. The government's draft energy concept is based on the development of nuclear power and the use of brown coal, while respecting mining limits. The government is due to discuss the energy plan before the end of the year. Czech lender Komerční banka is reviewing its dividend policy to pay out more than 70% of its profit and is looking at a range going up to 100%, the Reuters news agency reports. The Czech Republic's third biggest bank by assets, majority owned by Société Générale, said earlier its capital adequacy stood at 17.1%, above its target of 15-16%, and repeated it was reviewing its dividend guidance of paying out 60-70% of net profit. The forex interventions launched by the Czech National Bank last year in order to weaken the crown have brought a higher number of tourists to the Czech Republic. In the first two quarters of 2014, the number of tourists from neighbouring countries rose on average from 6 to 10%, with the highest number of visitors from Germany, Austria and Slovakia. However, the interventions negatively affected the profit margins of travel agencies. Czech retail sales growth accelerated more than expected in September, according to data released by the Czech Statistics Office. Retail sales increased at a pace of 6.2% year-on-year in September, after rising 2.7% a month ago. Economists had forecast a 5.3% rise for September. On a monthly basis, sales gained 0.3%. Hilton Prague, the largest Czech hotel, has been put up for sale. Avid Asset Management, the current owner of the hotel, empowered the real estate firm JLL to mediate the deal. The asking price was not disclosed. The new owner will be able to change the hotel's name. With over 7,000 square meters of meeting space, Hilton Prague ranks among the largest conference hotels in Central and Eastern Europe. A reminder that you're with Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's now time for our main feature, the arts. Fans of urban fantasy may be interested to learn more about Come Hell or High Water, a trilogy written by New York-based author Stephen Morris, a former Eastern Orthodox chaplain at Columbia University. His series, set in Prague, not only blends past legend with the present, but meticulously works with occult European magical practices and beliefs. In his interview with Stephen in April of this year, Jan Wellinger began by asking about the author's fascination with magic and how well magic and religion mix.
Well, it depends on how you define any one of those elements. When I was very small, I was terrified of the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz and ran from the room as soon as she appeared in Munchkinland in the fire and the smoke. But the next year, when I was 5 or 6, I made myself stay and watch the rest of the movie, and I was enamored of her, that she became my favorite character, partly because she's the only one that has any real power in all of Oz. Everyone else is working with illusion and persuasion. The only real magic is wielded by the Witch of the West. And I fell in love with fairy tales as a result. And when I was in fourth grade and came to the conclusion that God existed, part of the thrill of that realization was that the supernatural existed, perhaps not in exactly the same way that as the fairy tales and the Brothers Grimm described them, but certainly the world was much larger than I had heretofore imagined or thought possible, that many things, many possibilities opened up, miracles, saints, angels. And then also, as I got older, I realized that although magic has been consistently condemned by the church, the practices that define magic are very elusive and have never been consistent. And so things that are considered science and perfectly acceptable in one era are considered magic and not acceptable in another era. And if you go looking at the definitions of magic, even in pre-Christian Europe, pretty much magic is anybody else's religious practice that you don't like. So the Roman definition of magic was precisely the religion of the Chaldeans and the Mesopotamians and the Babylonians and all the non-Roman peoples. And the reason it was illegal was because it was usually associated, if you were practicing a non-Roman religion, you were probably involved in some kind of treason or traitorous rebellion. So that definition of magic, other people's religious practice, is pretty much what the church settled on. And the various things that have been condemned have always been the Protestants accuse the Catholics of magic, the Catholics accuse the Protestants of magic, and even in Russia, there's a 16th century council that says a certain text is a prayer when a priest says it, and it's a spell when a layman says it, which really undergirds magic is simply illicit religious practice.
Was it your interest in the history of magic that eventually led you to also study medieval history?
I think they went hand in hand. I loved medieval history, castles, knights, dragons. And when I was a young boy in Seattle, my relatives said, oh, Steve likes history. Let's take him to the museum. But all the museums in Seattle are about Japan and Native Americans. And I kept saying, where's the castles? Where's the dragons? And when I went to college on the East Coast at Yale, and I remember so distinctly right before Christmas, freshman year, realizing that it was closer and quicker and cheaper to go to London than back to Seattle, and I could literally feel the axis of the earth shift under my feet.
If you have an interest in castles, the Czech Republic is not a bad place to go. There's certainly a good many of them here.
It's beautiful.
When it comes to urban fantasy, do you think that Prague is a location that has been utilized often?
To my knowledge, not yet. I understand Dan Brown was here a couple weeks ago scoping out the place for one of perhaps his next book, and one of the critics reviewing my books called me the Dan Brown of Prague, so maybe he'll be the Steve Morris of Prague next. But I think Prague is just waiting to burst into the urban fantasy landscape because there's so much wonderful material to work with here that it's really sad that it hasn't been tapped yet, but I'm very glad to be the first one to open those doorways.
You have London, Paris, those are sort of central locations, but this country does have a very rich tradition, you know, when it comes to, I guess, legends and magic and fairy tales, all of that.
Oh, there's so much here. Just walking around the old town, you have the thief who broke into St. Jacob's Church and who was caught by the statue. You have the priest who killed the prostitute in Our Lady of Tin and now lurks in the alleyway. You've got the miser running from his house near the Old Town Square, burning, sort of repeating his death, clutching his money. You've got the black dog up by Loretto, who is a character in my stories. And for the life of me, I tried and tried and tried and couldn't find his origin story. So I had to create an origin story for the black dog at Loretto, but the chasm to hell there, it's an amazing cornucopia of material here.
Now, the first book in your trilogy opens with a bang. The prologue is very entertaining, and it's written at a very filmic pace.
Thank you.
What I noticed as a reader was your attention to detail, not only because it was unusual, but also because it felt very much in place. When one of the main characters is accused of being a witch in the year 1356, she's treated exactly as one would expect, or at least as you would expect it with some knowledge of how these things were conducted. She's first dunked into the river to see if she sinks. How important was it for you as an author to stick to historical facts like the dunking, even though you're telling a fantasy?
Oh, it was very important to me because I really wanted the magic to be what stood out. There's no point in gratuitously offending people who know what you're writing about. So you stick to history as much as possible. And in fact, the magic is all based on authentic medieval and Renaissance occult practices. So the books could just as easily be a how-to manual if you want to do some of these things. But it was very important to stick to the truth as much as possible so that a reader would know when I departed from the truth. For instance, the witch that's burnt in the prologue, in reality, no one was ever executed for witchcraft here in Bohemia. And so the German priest at Our Lady of Tin, in fact, is the one who riles up the crowd to lynch her. so that there's no official record of it, because it wasn't a legal action. So that explains why she could be killed and not leave any legal trace.
I was caught up in the pace, but I kept thinking ahead, will the king's men show up? Will the king's men show up? And it was with a certain satisfaction, or maybe relief, that they did, because at that point I knew, okay, that's what should have happened.
Yes, yes.
Finca, the condemned witch, essentially curses the city.
Yes.
She gets the ball rolling. In the present day, we're introduced to Magdalena. Who is she? What role does she play as a central character?
Well, Magdalena is a secretary at the Charles University who's very bored with her life and has dabbled a little bit with Wicca and some New Age magic, but she's really kind of lost and looking for some excitement and something to do with herself. And she meets the ghost of Finca underneath the Charles Bridge. In fact, Finca is paddled up in a boat to meet Magdalena, and there's this giant woman in the boat. Magdalena at first doesn't realize who Finca is with, but it turns out that it's the troll who lives under the bridge, who likes to drown people and rule the dead whose bodies are in the waves. But Finca is brought by the troll to meet Magdalena, and Finca convinces Magdalena that justice was not served on that day in 1356, and that it's up to Magdalena to set the record straight, to clear Fenka's name, and so Magdalena sets out to do exactly that. And she thinks she's going, by setting history straight and clearing Fenka's name, that she's also going to begin the process of unraveling centuries of oppression against women and religion against freedom, and that she will actually be the linchpin in quite a momentous social revolution. So she's quite thrilled and excited to finally be able to have this opportunity and to actually experience the supernatural as a reality.
The topic of the suppression of women, of course, is something that also came up in the Da Vinci Code there, that the role of Mary Magdalena was suppressed, basically, historically.
Right.
Is this a central motif as well of New Age or Wicca, this kind of belief that women had a much greater role in, say, the...
In pre-Christianity?
in the pre-Christian traditions, that this is something that maybe wasn't as well known in the past, but now has sort of become part and parcel.
It's certainly become part and parcel of the modern image of what pre-Christian religions in Europe were based on. It's hard to know exactly how much of that is truth and how much is our reading back into the record. Roman religion does not seem to have been particularly woman-friendly. Celtic religion possibly more so, but it's still difficult to actually discern the record because there's no living memory of these religions, although some people like to claim that they survived in the forests and the dens and the crooks of European wilderness. But a lot of what we now think of as pagan religion was reinvented in the 1850s. It takes a lot of elements from a lot of different places.
If we look at some of the fiction coming out these days, it seems that fantasy, science fiction, 5 minutes into the future novels, they've all become a little bit more mainstream than they used to be. Is this a benefit or a curse? You have, for example, The Walking Dead. It was a comic book. It's now become a mainstream television series about zombies. I didn't think that I would ever see that happen.
No, to tell the truth, I never thought I would see any of that happen, too. I always thought I was the strange one in high school. And here, all of a sudden, the nerds have taken over. The zombies, Game of Thrones, True Blood, all these things are just racking up the points and the rating system like crazy. I think it's nice that we finally got our due, that everyone sees what we've always seen all along. It's gratifying and surprising. I never expected it.
What do you think is the attraction? Is it some people would charge that it's escapist to sort of go into fantasy worlds when we have enough things that we should be dealing with?
Any great literature is escapist. We all need to check out of this world for a couple hours and read a good book or see a good movie and just take a break. That's why all the musicals and the dance spectaculars were so popular during the Depression in the United States, that people just need to get away from their regular, mundane, not-so-pleasant lives sometimes. And I think fantasy isn't a particularly good way. especially urban fantasy, because it keeps you rooted in this world, in the contemporary society, so that it's familiar, but then it adds the thrill of magic that actually works.
Stephen Morris, author of the Prague-based urban fantasy Come Hell or High Water, ending that edition of The Arts with Jan Vellinger. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's programme from Prague. You'll find us online at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then please write to english@radio.cz. This is Danielle Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today and goodbye.